7 p.m. at the Doug Fir, 830 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
My name's Joseph Gallivan, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Peter Cassander, Rebecca Lingerfilter, and Isaac Lamb. They're with Third Rail Repertory Theatre, and they're talking about the set design of The Angry Brigade, a play which is on now through April the 15th at Imago Theatre. Thanks for coming into KBOO.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Peter, you're the set designer, and this play is called The Angry Brigade. It's about the Angry Brigade, which you may have heard of if you lived in Europe in the 70s, but maybe you wouldn't if you lived around here. Who are the Angry Brigade, or were?
So the Angry Brigade was Britain's homegrown terror movement, I guess. Sort of a parallel to the Bader-Meinhof gang in Germany, for example, or the First of May movement in Spain. They made little bombs, trying to sort of shake things up in Britain.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and more specifically, the play at least centers around four members of the Angry Brigade: Jim Greenfield, Anna Mendelsohn, John Barker, and Hillary Creek, who were sort of famously captured by the police in the UK in the early 1970s, and had planted all these bombs around London that were aimed at the structures of sort of the government and popular culture and things like that, blew the doors off of cabinet ministers' offices and houses and all of that. And it became sort of the longest legal trial in English history. So they were very sort of an of-the-moment movement of the early 1970s and political unrest and domestic terrorism.
Mm-hmm. So this play is by James Graham. He's English and he's young, so he's working from, you know, secondary sources and sort of interpreting things probably happened before he was born. And it's, so there's a kind of nostalgic element to it. You know, it's like the 70s, and the play opens, you're in this, you're looking at this office, and there's like old dial phones and old filing cabinets. It's all very analog, lamps, desk lamps. It's kind of empty. So what was your idea with the opening, you know, setting, because it's the police, it's Scotland Yard.
Well, yeah, so Graham, the playwright, he gave us a communique at the beginning of it, not unlike what the Angry Brigade sent to the police. And in it, he sort of lays out some structures, the structures by which one would make the play, or he'd propose making the play. And in that, there's a sort of pointing at the circularity. So there's the branch and the brigade, and they're played by the same cast members in the piece.
There's two men, two women, and I guess the exciting thing is the second half is all about the brigade, but you recognize the actors.
From the branch, from the first half.
Yeah, the special branch, right?
Exactly. It's a special branch of Scotland Yard, and so the sort of nominal location is a basement of New Scotland Yard, which is a relatively new building at the time, and sort of the secret bunker where this new special branch is being assembled to hunt for the brigade, because the sort of traditional policing methods of Scotland Yard, at least in Graham's play, are failing to figure out what to do to find these people, find these terrorists. And so they assemble a team of young detectives, basically, to find them. So my job as the set designer was to take this sort of yin-yang setup that was in the communique. First we'll do the branch and then the brigade, or you could switch it, which was offered to us, but we chose not to do that. And then sort of create an environment that could contain both and transform from one to the other. That was very important to us. In other productions, they've done it fairly minimally with furniture and projections only. We took on the far more difficult task of creating an environment that physically transforms. So without the sort of speed of projections, we had the room really transform. The walls shake, shift, explode. Mm-hmm. The ceiling explodes.
So when you come in, you're in your theater seat looking, and there's a sort of five... It's like you're in half a decahedron, I guess. It's like five walls at different angles. I don't know how you describe this. And they're made of black brick. It looks like black brick. And then gradually, as the play goes on, these bricks fall apart, pop out. People kick them in, pull them out. And then you see through that, and you see studs and, you know, more room behind in the second half. So you're using... you begin with a very solid background, and the cast members are playing like very solid people. That's the metaphor. And then as Act One goes on, these police become more and more excitable, and the set transforms. Is that correct?
Yeah. So the environment has to sort of shift to follow the sort of narrative, or is helping us tell the story. And as the police get closer and closer, or having more and more trouble finding the brigade, they realize they need to get sort of on the same page. They have to think like the branch has to think like the brigade, and so they have to start acting like the brigade.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's sort of the strict order of Scotland Yard detectives starts falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And so the whole environment does the same. It becomes messy, becomes strange, and then after the intermission, after the break, where it's the opposite. It's the branch, and they smash through the walls and upset their secret hiding flat. They've rented a secret flat, not in the neighborhood the police have been looking in, and make this their secret hideout. But as they smash through the walls, we see other rooms. We sort of see the... society they're hiding in that they're trying to knock down, or at least that was the sort of metaphor we used as we were talking about what the room should be. The playwright suggests you should do lots of projections in this piece.
Video
projections.
Okay.
And we were like, no, that's not for us.
And for who's us? Third rail?
No, this production team, Rebecca, Isaac, and I, and the rest of the production team, the rest of the artistic team of this production. We got kind of excited about all of the analog technology that was mentioned in the script, particularly in that first half. So they talk about slide projectors. So we went out and made real analog slides and use, you know, out-of-date actigraphic slide projectors to display them. We used real phones that we got to ring. Those aren't sound cues. We hand built, and it looks like a bomb. It's hysterical. It looks like an improvised bomb. Not that improvised bombs are hysterical, but the box we had to build to be able to distribute all the phones and get them all to ring.
Oh, really?
It's this really beautiful, strange box we made.
When you say built, you mean you had to do the electronics?
Like I soldered wires together and
really?
And yeah.
You can't now buy a phone system?
Nope.
Wow.
Yeah, what's fascinating is there's all this technology that used to be so commonplace. And the joke that we often made during the technical process was, you know, if only I'd saved everything from my grandparents' basement, we would have had the entire set for the Angry Brigade. But it's hard to make slides anymore. It's hard to find people who develop film and can do it on a schedule that allows you to make what used to be so commonplace, just simple slides.
Mm-hmm.
Same thing with the phone. So there's all this analog technology, actually, that does take us back to the 1970s that were part of the production design for the show.
So that was you, Isaac, as a co-director. To me, the first half, where you're dealing with very straight-laced police officers, felt a bit Monty Python. It was a bit John Cleese. It was a parody from the beginning. Mm-hmm. Whereas the second half was much more where you're dealing with the Angry Brigade. I don't know what kind of theatre you call that, but it's a lot more sort of realistic, or it's very emotional.
Naturalism.
Yeah. Does that reflect in the set at all, or in the visuals?
I hope so. I think Peter was right in saying that sort of in the design of the show, we took a little bit from this communique Peter talked about that the author writes to us. But we also sort of found our own way through that suggestion, which is that rather than thinking of it strictly as a sort of yin and yang kind of relationship, that within each half of this equation exists the other half inherently. And so you watch this set fall apart, but there's been this other set sort of hiding behind it all throughout, and you just haven't known it's there. And so that the anarchists and the, you know, the sort of conservative police detectives would actually sort of naturally move towards each other as the play went on. So they kind of meet in the middle at this intermission event where the set starts to get sort of stripped down to its barest form. But then towards the end of the second act, it would also move back towards what you saw at the beginning, which is the mm-hmm. suggestion of structure and rooms and walls. And that's indicated in the text somewhat. But I think in terms of Rebecca and I, in terms of our directing, tried to move the performances in such a way that it would sort of start with, I think you're right to say, Monty Python. That's definitely in there in the text. And sort of moved, felt very different at the halfway point, but then try to move the play, I think, sort of naturally moves back towards that sort of more classic theatrical style as the second act goes on as well.
Mm-hmm. So the actual plot is there are four police officers, two men, two women, and one of them is like the sort of algorithm genius. You know, he knows patterns. He stares at maps. He gets people to stare at the map and like try and see a pattern. And he's the one who gets most excitable and ripping his shirt off, and he instigates the sort of anarchist tendencies. Did he have a lot of stage direction that indicated how he would act visually?
You mean in the play itself, in the text itself?
In the text, yeah.
I think some of it is in there, or at least the indication of what happens to the group. The group event, probably not spoiling anything to say that there's sort of an orgiastic event at the end of Act One. That certainly is in the text and we as directors and as the actors, you know, in the piece, they also had to find their way to that point. And so... working in concert with Nick Ferrucci, who is the actor that rips his shirt off,
mm-hmm. the guy with the mustache,
that as he connected and started to think more and more like the brigade, that he would, his behavior would change. And so those mileposts are kind of in the text itself, and then we had to sort of build the road in between.
Mm-hmm. And just tell me, Peter, that just before the first act ends, all this stuff drops from the ceiling. Mm-hmm. It's the first indication that things are going to go kind of crazy with the set. What is that stuff?
Oh, it's off-cut foam that we've painted, mostly.
Black.
Some crumpled paper. Yeah, that's it.
Okay.
That's all it is.
Meant to be the ceiling falling in?
It's the whole society falling in. I don't know. It's meant to be debris. We're actually supposed to see it in silhouette, and that's all it really is. It was just sort of the sense that everything's being shaken down, and that there's a crack in it all. Because in fact, in truth, it's right. It's in the moment in the narrative where the police are raiding the squat, but that means they're not punching holes in the ceiling. That's not what's going on. There's no realistic cognate for what it is.
Yeah.
It's just to sort of up the ante on the moment in some ways, just more than just.
So you had license, you know, I mean, people do kick walls in the other half, the second half, but you had license to do kind of metaphorical things.
Yeah. I think the script has some beautiful images built into it in the text that I felt the need to ability to sort of physicalize, put on stage. There is a detail that is historical in the police raids they came across when they were raiding the squats, a squat where the people had removed, the squatters had removed all the walls from around a toilet, and it was just sitting in the middle of a room.
Mm-hmm.
And that's referenced in the play.
Mm-hmm.
What's this toilet doing in the middle of the room? And so the idea that we could just get to do that. That's such a beautiful visual image to recreate. So we're putting a toilet in the middle of the room. That's one of the anchors of this piece. We know that. So in my original conception of the set, the first act and the second act kind of blurred together at the intermission break more than they do in our final production. And we discovered that the overlap wasn't as needed, that actually the separation was better. And so in my original thinking about it, or my original proposition, the walls would have burst in as part of the police raid where they catch the angry brigade, and then the brigade would come back on stage and then talk about bursting down walls. And so it was a better image for us, we discovered, to have the walls burst down by the brigade themselves instead of by the police at the end of the first act. And so that changed sort of the metaphor, how we made the play. Mm-hmm. But the same muscles were in place, the ability to destroy the walls and the sort of debris falling from the ceiling and the destruction. I proposed at one point, we should do it without an intermission. We should just keep going nonstop. And everyone was like, do you know how long this play is? We need a break.
I must say, I thought it was the end when the first act ended because it was so long.
But you enjoyed it, right?
Oh, yeah. It was great. My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week are Peter Cassander, Rebecca Lingefilter, and Isaac Lamb. They're with Third Rail Repertory Theatre, and their play The Angry Brigade is on there now through April the 15th. So Rebecca, you're the co-director with Isaac, and you obviously worked with the actors, who they don't just double up. There's four and four characters. They also play other characters, so there are other anarchists who are hauled in for questioning, and other anarchists that they meet to get guns from and things like that. How hard was it to get them to play so many roles?
It was actually one of the joys of the process, I'd say. You know, it's actually rare to have a play where actors get to play so many different kinds of characters. So I felt like the actors really embraced the challenge of it. I'd say one of the ways that we rooted the character changes in the show was actually in the dialect. So it's a very British play in many ways, and there's a lot of sort of differentiation of the characters based on class, and so dialect became a really important sort of rooting system for the actors to sort of start there, and then from the dialect, from the voices, I would say, they then found physicality. And it's kind of a layering process, right? You sort of start with one layer, add in the physicality, add in the intention and the given circumstances, and then the costumes add this whole other layer that you get in tech. So it's sort of like watching a process of discovery for the actors. But I would say the dialect had a huge impact on the work they did. And we worked with a company member, Stephanie Gaslin, was our dialect coach on the show, and did a huge amount of work with them.
So who are the four characters? Because the brigade are slightly more interesting and dynamic than the four cops. The brigade are, you've got your posh Cambridge guy, you got your working class Cambridge guy, and then the two women, you got the sort of posh girl who wants to play dolls and then tea sets and Wendy houses. And then what's the other one's sort of?
Yeah, I mean, they both went to the same college together. So they were both, again, educated, coming mostly.
The women?
Yeah, the women.
Okay.
In the sort of true story of the Angry Brigade.
Yeah.
They were actually all friends. They were all dating each other and friends in college.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and I think you're right. You get much more of the backstory of the characters in the second act. I think that part of that is Graham's interest in the brigade itself and sort of the root cause of why they did what they did. So you get a lot more of this kind of psychological exploration of why a terrorist would become a terrorist, and the sort of the roots of that being in childhood. So and they're really fascinating people, you know, the class differentiation between Jim and John. They're both going to Cambridge, but one comes from the north, from a working class family, and one comes from, you know, the Tories, essentially, is what he owns. So that creates a really interesting dynamic amongst the group that I think James Graham was really interested in exploring. And the first act is really a comedic police procedural. You know, it has more of that kind of the mystery of the case that we're following.
Go ahead, Peter.
So with having the longest trial in the history of the British legal system, we have just more information about the brigade. Their stories, their histories were all sort of dissected as part of that. But the police aren't going to leave as much of a record or as rich of a historical record for the playwright to explore. So that makes some space for us to fill in. It's not a historical document that we feel any need to attach to.
Yeah. And then, so there is this toilet. It's pretty amazing. Oh, I should say that the it sounds like the Angry Brigade, the Foursome, are a breakaway group from a bigger squat in probably Notting Hill, and sound like Notting Hill. So they've gone east in London, and they even joke about it being nobody goes to this part of London. So they live it. They're kind of out, really out of the center of things. That shows how committed they are. And then they're in this place, and then you see this toilet, and you think, why is the toilet there again? So just tell us more about the toilet.
So the toilet, right, is this historical fact, detail that is included by the playwright in the script. And we just were sort of the sort of surrealism of that, of that image of having it in the sort of the center of a room, we took to be a sort of a great way to sort of structure our production, structure the space of our production. And so a sort of series of concentric circles all build out from that point. And it's hidden under a table in the first act and then revealed.
And somebody uses it, and then two people have sex on it. So it's kind of central.
We burn things in it. I mean,
that's right. Yeah.
All kinds of things happen. We not only is it center on stage, it's sort of, yeah, it's just sort of, it's the locus. It's the image that one of the images that we just attached to early on, and it's because it's so odd. It's so not what is supposed to happen, and making those kinds of images are just to shake things up, right? It's just and that's maybe part of what the brigade, or at least in the play, they claim is to try to shake people out of their normal world, their normal experiences. So they see it in a different way, and maybe they can see the issues that might want to be adjusted, things that might need to change in a society. So we put a toilet in the middle of the room.
So you have these beautiful maps on the walls. They look like, I don't know, where are they from? They look like 60s maps, or what are they?
They are. They're period maps from the Ordnance Survey, the British Government Ordnance Survey, of London, of the neighborhoods they think the Angry Brigade might be hiding out in, that the branch thinks that the Angry Brigade is hiding out in. And one of the pieces of research we found when we were just exploring the historical context of the script, we were looking at images from New Scotland Yard, and there's a map room there with these big panels, big wall-sized panels of maps of London. And so we thought, that's such a beautiful, weird room. What a cool thing, that we decided to try to recreate it as much as we could for this moment of finding the brigade. There's talk of maps in the stage directions, but not to the extent that we've included them in the room. One of the things we were trying to do was to make change the color of the room, so go from this black shiny brick, to a white room, sort of transform it, and then release them all to go back into the sort of shadowy hideout that the brigade is hiding in.
In the second act, the walls are smashed in. You can see back. You can see studs where the plasterboard has been torn off. And there's this brilliant scene where someone is talking about people watching TV and how sort of moronic it is. And the two men sit there as though they're in a tower block, and there's light flickering in, and it's the same pattern of light on their faces. And that's when someone explains they were watching the same show. That seemed to be a sort of generous moment of, you know, visual. You put a lot of work into that. Was that just one of many things you could have done, or, you know, where did that image come from?
I mean, one of the big questions for Isaac and I was how to think about staging the second act, because there's no stage directions, there's no scene differentiation. It's one big, long, kind of flowing stream of consciousness amongst the four actors. So our decision was to have the actors sort of recreate the stories that they were telling to each other, in the idea that this squat becomes a kind of lost boys hideaway, you know, that we are in a kind of Peter Pan world where there are no adults and they can behave the way they want to behave, and that there's this kind of imaginative storytelling aspect to that world that is the actors themselves enacting the stories that they're telling each other. So we worked with the actors to generate a lot of those moments. So a lot of it was actor driven. We'd sort of say, make a version of what this story would be. And I believe they came up with that idea. The actors themselves came up with that idea.
They came up with the visual?
With the visual, with the flashlights. So a lot of that second act was really driven by the actors and the directors working together to create the world of this kind of imaginative storytelling.
Mm-hmm. So there, it's interesting when you have terrorists who are sort of well-groomed and you wonder, why do they do it? You know, like Al-Qaeda, all doctors and lawyers and stuff. What was the attraction for all of you for putting on this play now?
Yeah, I mean, I think the play really asks you to look at what seemingly on the surface is two really distinctive ideologies and see the ways in which they're actually totally entangled with each other, and that the people themselves aren't that different, that they have needs and wants and desires that are really human, ultimately, when you get down to the fundamental of who they are. So I think in a world that feels so divided by binary, by this idea and that idea, the idea of getting in a room together in the theater to watch people grappling with that kind of divided society and getting down, drilling down into what really is at the foundation of that, seems really important, seems useful to do together as a group.
My name is Joseph Gallivan. You've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guests this week were Peter Cassander, he's a set designer, Rebecca Lingerfilter and Isaac Lamb, they're co-directors of a play called The Angry Brigade. It's put on by Third Rail Repertory at Imago Theatre on Southeast 8th Avenue at number 17. It's opposite KBOO. Oh, it's $10 off if you book online, if you're a KBOO member and you use the word brigade. The Angry Brigade is on now through April the 15th. Thanks very much for coming into KBOO.
Thank you so much.
Thanks. Thank you.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Portland Underground Grad School. Classes that begin in April include Talking Across the Political Chasm, Facebook Marketing, Reading Ta-Nehisi Coates, How to Train, Getting Serious About Being a Learning Organization, and more. Portland Underground Grad School is also known as PUGS. Classes take place all over the Portland metro area. Information about registering, teaching classes, and more can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Nez Perce Tribe Land Buyback Program outreach events, April 4th at the Chinook Winds Casino in Lincoln City, and April 5th at the Nara Wellness Center in Portland. The Nez Perce Tribal Land Buyback Program outreach is to inform landowners about the buyback program, answer questions, and identify willing sellers. Again, that's the Nez Perce Tribal Land Buyback Program information events, April 4th, 8 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Chinook Winds Casino, 1777 Northwest 44th Street South in Lincoln City, and April 5th, 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. at the Nara Wellness Center, 12360 East Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Esto es Tania Gómez Daza para KBOO News. A continuación, un corte informativo en español para el día 4 de abril. El Consejo Nacional Electoral de Ecuador anunció que el candidato oficialista y ex vicepresidente Lenín Moreno se impuso con 51% de votos ante el empresario derechista Guillermo Lasso, quien obtuvo 48% en la segunda vuelta de la elección presidencial celebrada en Ecuador el pasado domingo. La victoria de Moreno da un alivio a la debilitada izquierda latinoamericana y también a Wikileaks, ya que Guillermo Lasso había amenazado que de resultar ganador sacaría de la Embajada de Ecuador en Londres a Julian Assange. El Consejo Permanente de la Organización de Estados